Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
An uncertain future awaits Somali refugees, and both U.S. patients recover from the Ebola virus. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The UN Refugee Agency has called for East African countries hosting Somali refugees to make voluntary repatriation possible and sustainable. Earlier this month, some UNHCR workers and Somali refugee leaders in Dadaab camp traveled to Kismayo to assess the security and socioeconomic situation of the city as part of the repatriation process. A UNHCR spokesman in Kenya says security is a major challenge. Two American aid workers infected with the Ebola virus have recovered and left an Atlanta hospital. Bruce Ribner, the medical director of Emory University Hospital's Infectious Disease Unit, said in a news conference today that Dr. Kent Bradley had fully recovered, meaning he was symptom-free for at least 2 days with no virus in his blood system. Meanwhile, Brantley gave thanks to his doctors for treating him.
Today is a miraculous day. I am thrilled to be alive, to be well, and to be reunited with my family.
Meanwhile, Nancy Ritball was released from the hospital on Tuesday, but had asked to have her discharge remain private. An Israeli airstrike in the southern Gaza Strip has killed three senior Hamas commanders today, and the bombing of a four-story house in Rafah. The Israeli defense minister said the three were responsible for deadly attacks against Israel. This is VOA News. Interpol says the beheading of a U.S. journalist, James Foley, by Islamic State militants shows a need for a coordinated global effort to combat the threat posed by foreign fighters traveling to conflict zones in the Middle East. Interpol also said the act illustrates the depravity of the Islamic State fighters operating in Iraq and Syria. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says the Islamic State's horrific acts of terrorism are utterly evil.
The ISIL movement is as near to pure evil as we're ever likely to find, and there can be no compromise whatsoever with groups that are dedicated to the destruction of our way of life and the brutal murder of anyone who falls into their hands.
Again, that is the Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. A day after visiting the central U.S. town where demonstrators have protested daily against the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teen, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder today in Washington said that his brief trip on Wednesday to Missouri affected him like few events have in his time as head of the Justice Department.
There is a history to these tensions, and that history simmers in more communities than just Ferguson. While I went to Ferguson to provide reassurance, in fact, they gave me hope. My commitment to them is that long after this tragic story no longer receives this level of attention, the Justice Department will continue to stand with Ferguson.
One of the largest U.S. banks, the Bank of America, is paying a record fine of nearly $17 billion because of bad housing loans it sold to investors, helping trigger the world recession. It is the biggest settlement ever between the U.S. government and a private corporation. It was announced today by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder.
These loans contained material underwriting defects. They were secured by properties with inflated appraisals.
The Bank of America penalty follows a combined $20 billion in fines already imposed on two other large banks, J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, for their roles in selling weak home loans to investors ahead of the recession in 2008 and 2009. Russia's food safety agency is conducting safety checks on McDonald's fast food restaurants nationwide, a day after four McDonald's most popular Moscow locations were ordered to close. Russian health authorities said today they're looking at possible breaches of sanitation rules at a number of McDonald's locations. Critics say the government action is a form of retaliation for Western economic sanctions against Moscow. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
From our own observation, we think a lot of people are now aware about the signs and symptoms and the actions they should take. But that doesn't rule out the possibility that there are a lot of people who are refusing to go to the hospital.
That's Mohamed Sila, the country director for Action Aid in Sierra Leone. Details coming up.
Also in the news, security forces have sealed off the West Point squatters community in Liberia's capital in an effort to contain the spread of the Ebola virus. And Reuters reports health experts are investigating a disease outbreak in the DRC, which has killed several people.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Associated Press reports calm has been restored in the West Point squatters community in Liberia's capital. Security forces suddenly sealed off the area yesterday in an effort to contain the spread of the Ebola virus. Heavily armed police used tear gas and fired warning shots over the heads of hundreds of West Point residents. They protested when barbed wire and barricades were erected. Residents are prohibited from leaving to report for work or buy food. Offshore the West Point Peninsula, Coast Guard vessels monitor the shores where ferry service has been stopped. The UN World Food Program is preparing to deliver emergency food aid to West Point. Liberia also reports it has quarantined a second community, Dolo Town, 40 miles outside of Monrovia. This week, the UN reported quarantines of other West African cities and towns. These include Gekedu in Guinea, Kanema and Kalahun in Sierra Leone, and Foya in Liberia. Also, airlines such as Kenya Air and Ethiopian Airlines have stopped flights to affected countries. The World Health Organization reports that 1,350 people have died of the virus. The greatest number of fatalities has been in Liberia, where 576 deaths are reported.
Kim, the avoiding contact is the best prevention. Medical researchers suspect that humans initially contracted the Ebola virus from a species of bat and from other bush meat, which is a popular food in the region. Doctors Without Borders and other health experts warn against touching or eating bush meat from the forests. The Ebola virus is not an airborne disease. It is transmitted from human to human through blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, and the genital secretions of those who have contracted the Ebola virus. Health officials strongly advise people not to handle the bodies of patients who have died of Ebola. Instead, they should notify the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases and immediately report to a health center if they experience the symptoms of the virus. Early treatment can improve survival rates. Symptoms of the Ebola virus include high fever, headache, joint or muscle aches, sore throat, weakness, stomach ache, and lack of appetite. They may occur 2 to 21 days after infection.
Meanwhile, the international NGO Action Aid says it is responding to continued Ebola virus outbreaks and deaths in Sierra Leone by carrying out awareness-raising campaigns in affected communities. The organization has been distributing flyers door-to-door and presenting prevention information through dramas and discussions on radio and TV stations. Mohamed Sila is the country director for Action Aid in Sierra Leone. He said the awareness campaigns are working. However, many people are still afraid to go to healthcare facilities, and many with symptoms go into hiding.
From our own observation, yes, we think a lot of people are still aware about the signs and symptoms and the actions they should take. But that doesn't still rule out the possibility that there are lots of people who are refusing to go to the hospitals.
How are the workers on the ground then handling this situation with trying to get people to come into healthcare facilities if they're afraid to do that?
Well, there are two scenarios. One scenario is that you have a situation wherein some hospitals are not well equipped to handle Ebola emergency, and as such, The staff themselves have deserted the hospitals in some cases. You have very few staff. Even if you are sick, you go to the hospital, you will not meet a lot of people there. And secondly, that element of fear is still there, that when you go to the hospital, you will be quarantined and you may not have the possibility of coming out alive. Some of the fear is still there. And for me, it's really reluctant. And what we are trying to do as non-governmental organizations is still to intensify that aspect of educating people about the need to trust the health system and go to hospitals anytime they have any sort of symptoms, whether it's Ebola or not, to seek medical attention.
Do the healthcare workers there, do they have the necessary protective clothing that they need to treat Ebola patients?
I don't think they have, because for treatment, as of today, we still have only two treatment centers in the whole country, that is in the two epicenters of Kenema and Kailang. What is happening is that anywhere you bring in patients now, the others probably do not still have the right knowledge. Even though a lot has been done, I understand that recently even Center for Disease Control of the Chinese also did organize some training for health personnel, and there are a lot of other support that are going to train them. Other hospitals only have isolation centers, and until the test results are confirmed from the laboratories, you will not know whether the patient you are keeping is Ebola positive or not.
How many people would you say are dying on a daily basis from the virus?
Well, what is just clear from what I said, I know that the numbers have been increasing every other day. In some cases, it's really sometimes you have 10 new cases per day, some you have 20, 15, 8, 10. It is really not stable. And sometimes when we get low figures, it's because the other laboratory has not sent in their results. And when they send in their results on the next day, you see that the number of people that have been reported of positive or have died is the whole difference. From where I sit, I know within the month of August alone, we have lost a lot of people due to death, because in July we had only about 181 deaths. But as of the 20th, that figure had risen to over, I think, 230 deaths now. So that shows that you lost a lot. And when it comes to even confirmed cases, that is where you have the biggest jump. You have a jump of 518, which was at the end of July, and as of the 20th of August, that number has gone to 804 confirmed cases. So just within 1 month, you're definitely recording over 200 new infections.
The people that are dying from the Ebola virus, are they being buried properly?
All those that die in the treatment centers are often buried in the proper way so as not to transmit disease. And those who die in houses, and they also inform the health officials to come and pick up the bodies, they are buried in the proper way.
You mentioned earlier that people are still afraid to go into healthcare facilities to get treatment, whether it's for Ebola or something else, even though they are receiving information. So then, is this one of the main reasons that the virus is continuing to spread?
One, I would say the bigger reason definitely has to do with the confidence of the people to come to the treatment center. And indeed, government has been trying to bring up positive news about the number of people who have been healed. We have got over 200 people who have actually survived. But unfortunately, you still have scenarios of people hiding. It's probably one of the reasons why a lot of people are dying out of the hospital due to this disease.
That was Mohamed Sila, country director for ActionAid in Sierra Leone. He spoke with me from Freetown.
Reuters reports health experts are investigating a disease outbreak in the DRC which has killed several people. The country's health minister and others are traveling to remote northern Equatoria province. It is not clear at this time whether there is any connection to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. One resident of the area is quoted as saying at least 10 people have died, including 4 health care workers. He described symptoms similar to those of Ebola. The DRC does not share a border with the West African countries affected by Ebola. However, there have been several outbreaks of the disease in the country since it was first discovered there in 1976.
The UN Refugee Agency has called for East African countries hosting Somali refugees to make voluntary repatriation possible and sustainable. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Earlier this month, some UNHCR workers and Somali refugee leaders in the Dadaab camp travelled to the port city of Kismayu to assess the security and socio-economic situation of the city as part of the repatriation process. UNHCR in Kenya spokesman Emmanuel Nyabera says security is a major challenge in south and central Somalia, and the group's visit helps the refugees make decisions knowing what awaits them if they decide to go back.
They noticed that some areas needed a lot of support and concern, like the medical facilities were not as good as needed. Education system was a little bit a challenge because the curriculum was not very well defined. These are some of the things that they came and shared with refugees in the camps. And this will enable refugees to make informed decisions.
For more than two decades, Somalia has witnessed a cycle of violence that has forced about 2 million people to flee and displaced hundreds of thousands inside the country. Relative peace is returning to some parts of the country after African Union troops and Somali government forces pushed back Al-Qaeda-linked group Al-Shabaab. Despite the security challenges, Nyabera says the UN agency is ready to support those refugees willing to go back home.
We have to emphasize that so far we are not promoting repatriation as such, because most of the areas where Somalis want to go to, the southern central part of Somalia, are not safe enough. But then we are able to start preparations to see how many people want to go. We have opened information desks in the camps, all the five camps in Dadaab, where we are addressing some of the concerns of the Somali refugees.
Somali government representatives have withdrawn several times from negotiations on repatriation between Kenya and the UNHCR, citing human rights abuses against Somali refugees living in urban centres. In April, Kenyan security forces carried out a major security crackdown they say was intended to flush out Al-Shabaab members and sympathisers. More than 5,000 Somalis were arrested. Last month, humanitarian agencies warned of a possible famine like one 3 years ago that killed a quarter of a million Somalis. Aid workers fear a food shortage will force thousands of Somalis back to camps. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
At least 63 people have died in continuing clashes between two rival Arab groups in the Darfur region of Sudan. A Sudan radio station claims the death toll may have reached 300 as the nomadic Rizigat and Maliya tribes fight over land use and water rights in eastern Darfur.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new report says global spending for capital projects and infrastructure will top $9 trillion a year by 2025. That's up from $4 trillion in 2012. Asian countries, especially China, are expected to lead the way. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The spending projections are contained in a new report from PwC, with assistance from Oxford Economics. The report analyzes infrastructure spending in 49 of the world's largest economies. They account for 90% of the global economic output. The Outlook to 2025 report focuses on five sectors: extraction industries, utilities, transport, manufacturing, and social, which includes city infrastructure. The findings say emerging markets, mostly China and other Asian countries, will see much faster growth in infrastructure spending. One reason is because the region did not have the burden of recovering from a financial crisis. Another is big demand in China. Europe has recovered slowly from the economic crisis, which has constrained infrastructure spending, and spending in North America is a distant second to Asia. PwC's main role for its clients centers on audit and assurance, tax and consulting services. Jonathan Kaywood is the head of the firm's capital projects and infrastructure for Africa.
Africa's share of the global pie is 2%, but it's certainly growing quite significantly, and I think also we're seeing a significant uptick in spending across the region.
He lists the continent's leaders in infrastructure spending.
South Africa specifically has been dominant over the last few decades, but we see Nigeria catching up very quickly and probably in the next 2 to 3 years will overtake South Africa. And then the Eastern Corridor, Kenya is a gateway into Tanzania, Ethiopia, Uganda, and the resource-rich countries around there is also experiencing significant growth.
Nigeria's spending is forcast to grow from $23 billion in 2013 to $77 billion in 2025. Overall infrastructure spending in sub-Saharan Africa is forecast to grow by 10% a year over the next 10 years. If the forecast holds true, the amount would be more than $180 billion. Kaywood says where that money is spent could be affected by climate change.
Certainly when one looks at fragile power, transport and water and city infrastructure, often Africa is more exposed, so particularly along the east coast. A country like Mozambique is exposed to regular flooding, and with that comes disease and power outages and transportation going down. And I think when one looks at hydropower, there are big questions around the key river basins in Africa and whether the water level and volumes are going to be sustainable.
That sustainability could be hindered by more frequent droughts and floods, some of the effects of climate change. Infrastructure spending could also be affected by rapid urbanization. The PwC report projects the biggest shifts in urbanized populations will be in China, India, Ghana, Nigeria, and the Philippines. Kaywood says urbanization and demographic shifts will have implications for Africa's cities.
Most of them are growing very rapidly, often in a fairly unstructured way. Most of them are pretty gridlocked and oversubscribed in terms of basic services, whether it be housing, transport, ICT, water, power.
The report says demographic shifts will leave a lasting fundamental imprint on infrastructure development for decades to come. Africa will probably need some outside help in infrastructure development. China's infrastructure spending includes major investments in Africa. Kaywood describes it as formidable.
It by far dwarfs any other source of investment, and many of the projects in Africa are being delivered by Chinese funders and construction firms, often led by their state-owned entities.
Kaywood says driving most of the investment in Africa will be resource and consumer market potential, along with trade and economic and political reforms. He adds it's crucial for policymakers, citizens, and businesses to understand the factors that unlock infrastructure and development, and then act responsibly and strategically. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The offices of two law enforcement agencies in Pretoria, South Africa's Elite Hawks Drug Investigation Unit and Interpol's Anti-Corruption Unit, have been burglarized several times in the past 3 weeks. A police spokesman said computers and other office equipment have been stolen by using access cards and codes. Some of the equipment taken from the International Police Unit has been recovered from pawn shops. A security source said 5 break-ins have occurred in the building in the past 3 weeks. The source expressed concern that the repeated thefts may indicate thieves are looking for specific information from one of the agencies.
Coming up on 24 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United States acknowledged yesterday it launched an unsuccessful military rescue operation earlier this year to free American hostages held by Islamic State militants in Syria. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the announcement came the same day President Barack Obama condemned the execution of an American journalist and called for regional action to extract the extremist cancer before it spreads.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby said the United States attempted to rescue a number of U.S. hostages held by a particular captor network within IS in Syria. He said the air and ground operation was not successful because the hostages were not present at the targeted location. Presidential Assistant on Counterterrorism Lisa Monaco said the operation, which took place earlier this summer, was authorized by President Obama because of the assessment that the hostages were in increasing danger with each passing day. Rick Brennan, senior RAND Corporation political analyst and a career U.S. Army officer, says gaining actionable intelligence for such an operation is always a challenge. But he was surprised the Pentagon acknowledged publicly the unsuccessful mission.
Trying to get current intelligence for this type of operations is extremely difficult. We had so many attempts that were aborted, if you will, with bin Laden. Very rarely do you hear about the Department of Defense discussing these types of capabilities. So, yeah, it is odd that the Pentagon and the White House has come out to acknowledge that we conducted this type of raid and that it failed.
The Pentagon and White House statements were issued the same day Mr. Obama acknowledged the beheading of American freelance journalist James Foldy, seen in a gruesome video made public on Tuesday. He said the world is appalled by this brutal murder and denounced their acts of murder, abductions, torture, rape, and slavery.
From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread. There has to be a clear rejection of these kind of nihilistic ideologies.
Mr. Obama said there is no place for IS militants in the 21st century. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf Wednesday said Washington has spoken with a number of regional partners who understand how serious a threat IS poses.
We have talked to a number of partners who understand how serious the threat ISIL is, not just to Syria and Iraq, but to their countries as well. And countries in the region are very, very concerned about this. We've worked with them on working to cut off financing, working to cut off the flow of foreign fighters, so we can start to deprive ISIL of the oxygen that it's had and has really allowed it to flourish.
But terrorism expert Greg Barton, who heads the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University, says the terrorist threat continues to grow in the region and IS continues to add fighters to its ranks.
We used to think they had maybe 6,000 militants in Iraq and a similar number in Syria. We're now seeing multiples of that number. We do know that many more foreign fighters have come in over the last few weeks, and we know that they're recruiting locally as well. And it looks as if they now have some force strength in the several tens of thousands.
Barton says the brutal execution of Foley is designed to provoke an angry response from the West that may be a way for the Sunni extremist group to tell would-be donors and recruits the world is at war with Islam. So far, he says, the Western response has been restrained. Despite militant threats to kill another captive American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, over U.S. aerial attacks on IS targets in Iraq, those strikes continued Wednesday with another 14 in the vicinity of the recently recaptured Mosul Dam. Brennan says the United States has little choice but to continue its aerial campaign in support of Iraqi and Iraqi Kurdish operations against IS.
If you fail to take action because of a terrorist threat, then it binds your hands to do the types of things that protect U.S. interests. I think that it's absolutely impossible for the president to try to back down and not do what he thinks is right because of a threat of an American being killed.
Writing Wednesday in the Commentary magazine, Council on Foreign Relations national security expert Max Boots said what is needed now is a coherent U.S. military strategy to annihilate IS. He said that would include an enhanced air campaign, coupled with thousands of U.S. advisors and special operations troops working with moderate forces in Syria and Iraq to root out IS militants from their newly conquered territory. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, Please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Security forces have sealed off the West Point Squatters community in Liberia's capital in an effort to contain the spread of the Ebola virus. Coming up, we have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, health officials in Nigeria are Facebooking, tweeting, and writing radio jingles in an effort to educate the populace about the Ebola virus. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Well, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Thank you, Sunny, and same to you, too. And I understand a female football player from Nigeria is earning kudos.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Nigeria's Asisat Ashola, who's proving to be the big breakout star at the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. Asisat is nicknamed Super Z by her teammates on the Falconets of Nigeria, and she truly was super in a 6-2 thrashing of North Korea in the semifinals. Super Z scored 4 goals and set up the other 2 as the Nigerian girls moved within 1 victory of their first ever under-20 world title. Nigeria will play Germany in Sunday's final at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, Canada. The German girls defeated France 2-1 in the other semifinal. Let's get back to Super Z Asisat Ashola. She's 19 years old, and with those 4 goals against the North Koreans, Super Z is now the leading scorer at the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup with 7 goals total. Back home in Nigeria, Super Z plays for Rivers Angels Football Club in Port Harcourt. Her teammate on the Falconets, Ugo Njoku, also plays for Rivers Angels. And whenever Super Z has scored at the Under-20 Women's World Cup, she has sought out Njoku to celebrate with a little dance. Super Z's 7 goals in Canada have not surprised Njoku, who told FIFA.com, World Football's website, and I quote, "I was thinking before the World Cup that she could end up doing something like this. I believe in her and her tremendous strength." And speaking of Super Z's tremendous strength, another teammate, Loveth Anyila, made a special promise ahead of Sunday's final against the Germans, telling FIFA.com, "Asisat carried the coach around on her shoulders because she's the strongest and the only one able to do it. But if we win on Sunday, I promise that we'll all do it, and we're going to win."
I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game.
Just
Game on, sports fans. Now let's go to Rwanda, where the field is set for the semifinals at the CECAFA Kagame Cup Club Tournament. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma reports.
In Rwanda, Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority beat South Sudan's Atlabara 3-1 in quarterfinal action at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's CECAFA Kagame Club Championships in Kigali. Earlier on, following a scoreless stalemate in open play, Sudan's El Merrekh pipped Tanzania mainland's Azam 4-3 in a post-match penalty shootout. Kampala City Council, El Merrekh, and Rwanda's police and military side APR are through to the semifinals.
In the semifinals, APR will play police in an all-Rwandan matchup, and El Merrekh will meet Kampala City Council. The tournament is named after and sponsored by Rwandan President Paul Kagame. Our African football guru David Legg gives President Kagame high marks for his support of the sport on the continent. And David joins us now to talk about a top Tunisian club. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sonny, and good evening to all the football lovers around the continent.
The Tunisian side, Esperance, in turmoil regarding the coaching staff. VOA! How about an update for our VOA football fans?
Turmoil is exactly the word, Sonny. They've now had 5 CAF Champions League group matches, and they're now into their third coach. They lost the first 2 games and out went Ruud Krol of the Netherlands. And in his place came Sébastien Desabre, a young Frenchman. And I remember predicting, Sonny, on your show about a month ago that he was probably only as good a survivor as winning matches would allow. Well, he won his first match, so he made it to the second match, which they lost. But after that loss, they then drew with Entente Sétif and were eliminated from the competition. And no surprise to report to all our listeners around Africa that Sébastien Desabre has now been fired by the Blood and Gold, who are based in Tunis. And in a remarkable situation, he has been replaced by Khaled Ben Yahia, a former player at the club. But at the same time, there's also speculation that Roger Lemaire, the great French coach who led France to the 2002 Euro title, is poised to take over. So that begs the question, Sonny, how many defeats will Ben Yahia have to suffer before he too suffers the guillotine? As difficult and strenuous and stressful jobs in African football go, I would hazard a guess that right now being coach of Esperance Sportif, the Tunis, is certainly right up there at the top.
David, action coming up in both the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. Let's begin with the Champions League, David. And how about the fixtures?
Right, Sonny. The concluding fixtures on Friday, we've got El Hilal of Sudan at home to Zamalek of Egypt in Group A. And the other Group A match on Sunday in Kinshasa is Vita against TP Mazembe. Now, the one match that between Hilal and Zamalek is basically of academic interest only. The teams are playing for pride because the Vita Club and Mazembe have already qualified for the semi-finals. They're level at the top with 10 points each. But what has got to be decided is who finishes first. If Vita or Mazembe win, they will finish first. If the match ends in a draw, then Mazembe will finish on top. And interestingly, it's exactly the same situation in Group B, where on Saturday, CS Sfaxien host Entente Sétif, and then on Sunday, it's Esperance against Al Ahly Benghazi. Now, Esperance and Benghazi, they're out of contention. Sfaxien have got a 1-point lead over Sétif, so a draw at home will be sufficient for the Tunisians to finish on top. However, if the Algerian side Sétif win, they will finish on top. So we know the semi-finalists. They're Mazembe, Vita, Sfaxien and Sétif. But what will be decided this weekend, who finishes first and who finishes second in each group.
Let's turn now, David, to the CAF Confederation Cup. And what do the upcoming fixtures look like?
In Group A, Sonny, both on Sunday, it's Real Bamako of Mali against Cotton Spore of Cameroon and AC Leopards of Congo-Brazzaville against ASEC Mimosas of Ivory Coast. And then in Group B, both matches on Saturday, Sewe San Pedro of Ivory Coast against Nkana of Zambia, and Al Ahly of Egypt against Etoile Sahel of Tunisia. Let's go back to Group A, where we know the Cotton Spore have qualified, but whether they go through as winners or runners-up is yet to be decided. And then we've got a situation of Leopards having a three-point lead over Real. But Leopards have also got a far superior goal difference. They're plus four, whereas the Malians are minus one. And for Bamako to qualify, it really is a long shot. They would have to win by three goals and hope that Leopards lose at home by three goals. Now, there have been some big surprises in the Confederation Cup this year, but this is one I cannot see happening. So I can predict with some degree of confidence, I feel, that Leopards will advance along with Cotton Spore. But it is quite possible Cotton Spore can lose away to Real Bamako, in which case Leopards would top the group if they beat ASEC at home. Group B, far more complicated. No side has yet qualified. At the moment, Ahly have got 8 points, Nkana 7, Sewe have got 6, and Etoile have got 5. And the interesting thing is that even though Etoile are on the bottom rung of the ladder with their 5 points, they could still qualify for the semifinals. But it's a big ask. They've got to go to Cairo and they've got to beat Al Ahly in Egypt. I think a more likely situation is that Ahly will get at least a draw at home, and that will guarantee them a place in the semifinals. And then the really interesting one is in Abidjan, with Sewe needing a win, and against Nkana, who just need a draw. And with home advantage, perhaps the Ivorians have got a slight advantage there. So my predictions for the semifinals, Sonny, Cotton Spore, Leopards, Ahly, and Sewe.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Voice of America intern Daniel Brown steps up to the plate as guest blogger in the latest post titled Pitching Prodigy Monet Davis. Monet is 13 years old, and she recently made history as the first girl to pitch a shutout at the Little League Baseball World Series in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. In reaction, Sports Illustrated magazine put Monet on the cover, making her the youngest athlete ever to appear on the cover of the magazine. And while Monet is earning headlines and magazine covers for her baseball exploits, as Daniel writes in the blog post, her favorite sport is basketball, and she'd one day like to have a professional career in the Women's National Basketball Association. Good luck, Monet Davis. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. Well, I hope she can stay focused with all the attention that she's getting there.
Lots of attention, yes.
Well, you can listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, health officials in Nigeria educating the populace about the Ebola virus. And next, South Africa promoting a luxury tourism industry that permits people to hunt elephants, rhino, and other African wildlife. But first, some music. Here is Roki Dawuni of Ghana with Master Plan.
Africa, make you light my fire, and I'll be. this great promise of every new day. Forget your worries outside your gates. Love will lead us to different new way. Dance and let go of favorite trouble. Hand in hand we carry each other. Come on people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving, surviving now. Come on people, meditate, go higher. Ghana people, make you take it, go higher. Come Africa, make you light my fire. And I'll be proud. I could not believe the news today. Another hero falls in South Africa. Wipe your tears and fears away. All you children from Africa, Jamaica, sing new songs of joy and redemption. Wave your flags in celebration.
Come on, Rocky Duwani of Ghana with Master Plan.
The Nigerian government says communication is its first line of defense against Ebola. With no known cure and new fears about a potentially infected corpse found at a mortuary, health officials are Facebooking, tweeting, and writing radio jingles in an effort to reach everyone in Africa's most populous country. As Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja, their main message is, wash your hands.
If there can be such a thing as good news about Ebola, there was good news in Nigeria. Minister of Information, Laban Maku.
At the moment, there has not been any single additional incident of infection that has been reported. And this is important because we're beginning to see some panic reports, particularly in the social media.
New fears are rising.
When we had the information, we had to establish something because then...
This is Anambra State Health Commissioner Joe Akabuke speaking on local television. He says police have shut down a mortuary in his state, fearing the body of a man who died in Liberia and was transported to be buried in Nigeria was infected with Ebola. Mortuary workers have been isolated as a precaution as they await results of blood tests from the body. In neighboring Delta State, residents of Warri, a crowded, chaotic oil city, say they fear an Ebola outbreak in Anambra would quickly reach them. Mike Iginny runs a medical lab in Warri. He says the most frightening thing about Ebola is that medical workers are the most likely to get infected.
There is much fear and there's apprehension already. Because we don't know whether it's going to spread to this place very soon, or even if it's already even in our state now, we don't know. Do no... Major case has been reported, but there is fear all over the place.
Alleviating fears, he says, would require a massive education campaign that lets everyone know how to protect themselves from getting infected. And officials say that is exactly what they're doing. Again, Minister Maku.
We're adopting different channels to reach out to the people. The traditional media, radio and television, we have agreed on programs in the next couple of days. Weeks, you will see programs on television.
Health officials are also posting information about how the disease spreads and numbers to call for questions or to report illnesses on their Facebook page that are being tweeted by other agencies, like the Nigerian police. And while about half of all Nigerians don't have access to electricity, let alone Twitter, next week officials say Ebola information will be sent to people's mobile phones. And the messages they will send are fairly simple. Health officials urge people to avoid handling bats or primates or eating unregulated bushmeat. Most importantly, they say, the public is urged to wash their hands after touching people or surfaces, especially in a hospital. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
As Thailand and other Asian countries battle to contain the illicit ivory trade fueling the mass slaughter of elephants by poachers, South Africa promotes a luxury tourism industry that permits people to hunt elephants, rhino, and other African wildlife. Critics frown on the blood sport, but others argue that trophy hunting generates crucial revenues for the nation's conservation of big game animals. Gillian Parker has more from Johannesburg.
Trophy hunting for big game is a controversial blood sport. Parts of the animals, such as the skin, horns, or head, are kept as a hunting trophy, and the carcass is often used as food. It is legal in some African countries where it is a lucrative business. A 10-day elephant package could cost $36,000, and hunting a rhino could set you back a hefty $100,000. It is an emotive issue. A 19-year-old college cheerleader from Texas provoked uproar in July after posting pictures of herself posing with African wildlife she had legally hunted on a trip here. The International Fund for Animal Welfare says the needless killing of endangered species for trophies is inherently unsustainable, economically short-sighted, ecologically unsound, and morally wrong. But not all conservationists agree. Some argue trophy hunting may be helping Africa's wildlife. Tourism and donations do not come close to covering the billions of dollars needed, says Professor John Hanks, former head of the Worldwide Fund for Nature in South Africa.
I think trophy hunting in South Africa is really absolutely essential if we're going to look for a long-term future for rhinos in the whole of Africa. And there's hardly a single country anywhere that can afford to run its national parks that they should be run. Here we are in South Africa, one of the richest countries in the continent. Kruger Park has 1 million visitors a year, and they still cannot afford to defend the rhinos.
Around 9,000 trophy hunters travel to South Africa annually, 90% of them from the United States. In 2012, foreign hunters spent $115 million in South Africa, where the hunting industry as a whole brings in more than $744 million annually and employs 70,000 people. It is the single most lucrative form of commercial land use. Herman Meerdrix, president of the Professional Hunters Association of South Africa, argues legal hunting is crucial to protecting wildlife.
The only way that there will be an incentive for those landowners to protect and keep on investing in rhino and protecting these rhino is if they have an economic value. They can only have an economic value if there is an end user who's willing to pay for that, and that is the trophy hunter.
South Africa has a rhino poaching crisis, and many see hunting as contributing to the extinction of the endangered species. Meerdrix argues permits would not be awarded to hunters if the animals were genuinely under threat, stating that what is hunted is insignificant to what is available. The number of animals allowed to be killed is controlled by CITES, an international oversight body for endangered species. Critics say the system is flawed, since monitoring quotas is left to individual governments. Susie Offord, Deputy Director of Save the Rhino, surprisingly argues that if managed properly, trophy hunting is a useful conservation tool.
In an ideal world, rhinos wouldn't be under the extreme pressure that they are facing today, and there wouldn't be any need for trophy hunting. But the reality is that rhino conservation is incredibly expensive.
Not every country in Africa has followed suit. Kenya has had a long-standing policy against trophy hunting. When banning it in 1977, the Kenyan government described it as a barbaric relic of colonialism. Criminal networks, coined as pseudo-hunters, have also exploited trophy hunting to launder horns into the illegal trade, where they command high prices on the black market in countries such as Vietnam and Thailand. South African officials say there have been an estimated 300 instances of rhino horn exports by pseudo-hunters since 2009. Since then, South Africa has stopped issuing hunting permits to nationals from the Czech Republic and Vietnam due to criminality. Conservationists like Susie Offord argue governments need to do more to fight criminality and reinforce hunting regulations.
It does need to be taken more seriously by governments. A lot more action. There needs to be a lot more cross-border collaboration. It's not going to be run by one country alone.
Much of the public will continue to view trophy hunters with contempt. For environmentalists, the matter is not so clear-cut. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rashad Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is appalled by the brutal murder of American journalist James Foley by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Foley, 40, was taken hostage nearly 2 years ago in Syria while courageously reporting on the conflict there. Jim Foley's life, said President Barack Obama, stands in stark contrast to his killers.
Let's be clear about ISIL. They have rampaged across cities and villages, killing innocent, unarmed civilians in cowardly acts of violence. They abduct women and children and subject them to torture and rape and slavery. They have murdered Muslims, both Sunni and Shia, by the thousands. They target Christians and religious minorities, driving them from their homes, murdering them when they can, for no other reason than they practice a different religion.
Clearly, ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings, said President Obama. They may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision and the collapse of any definition of civilized behavior. People like this, said President Obama, ultimately fail, because the future is won by those who build and not destroy. The world is shaped by people like Jim Foley and the overwhelming majority of humanity who are appalled by those who killed him. The United States, said President Obama, will continue to do what we must to protect our people.
We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done. And we act against ISIL, standing alongside others.
There has to be a clear rejection of this kind of nihilistic ideology, said President Obama. ISIL has no place in the 21st century. America's friends and allies around the world share a common security and a common set of values. And we will continue to confront this hateful terrorism, said President Obama, and replace it with a sense of hope and civility.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.